evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, July 8, 2019. A Congolese general is convicted of war crimes by the International Criminal Court.
The bodies of those killed, men, women and children and babies, were found in the banana field over the next days. Some bodies were found naked. Some had their hands tied up, and some had their heads crushed.
And the Sudanese opposition and military council prepare to sign a deal.
The ceremony is going to be next week. There's going to be like Prime Minister of Ethiopia, other presidents from the region and from international organizations, from the European Union and Troika countries and so on.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The International Criminal Court has convicted a Congolese warlord nicknamed the Terminator on 18 counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity. From Paris, Alicia Bryan reports, the ruling delivers an important victory in the ICC's prosecution team following a string of setbacks.
Now, Mr. Taganda, please rise. Mr. Taganda, for the reasons...
Former Congolese warlord Bosco Ntaganda listened intently but showed no emotion as presiding judge Robert Fremer read out the judgment. He is only the fourth person convicted of war crimes in the ICC's 17 years of operations. The ruling finds 45-year-old Ntaganda guilty of directly and indirectly committing heinous acts in the Democratic Republic of Congo's northeastern Ituri province in 2002 and 2003, when he headed the Union of Congolese Patriots, or UPC, militia movement. Among the acts, murder, rape, sexual slavery, and conscripting child soldiers. The atrocities aimed to drive the ethnic Lendu population out of Ituri. Judge Fremer recounted how Ntaganda killed an elderly man who served as a local Catholic priest. He also described another incident in which Ntaganda's forces rounded up, raped, and massacred at least 49 people. The judge said the killers used sticks, batons, knives, and machetes to do the job.
The bodies of those killed, men, women, and children, and babies, were found in the banana field over the next days. Some bodies were found naked, some had their hands tied up, and some had their heads crushed.
Ntaganda claimed his innocence throughout the trial. He has 30 days to appeal, with sentencing scheduled for a separate hearing. He faces up to life in prison. Rights groups are cheering the ruling.
Today is a very important day for justice.
Maria Elena Vignoli is International Justice Counsel at Human Rights Watch.
This long-awaited judgment really provides an important measure of justice for Bosco Ntaganda's victims in Ituri and sends a strong message to perpetrators of atrocities that even those believed to be untouchable can one day be held to account.
The ruling also gives a much-needed boost to ICC prosecutors after the acquittal of former Ivorian President Laurent Gbagbo earlier this year and that of former Congolese Vice President Jean-Pierre Bemba on appeal in 2018. But HRW's Vignoli says thousands of Congolese victims still await justice for years of atrocities in conflict-torn parts of the country. She says they include some Ntaganda's forces allegedly committed in DRC's East Kivu provinces, and which were not covered in this trial. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Some civil society activists are calling on President Salva Kiir to give an update to the South Sudanese people on the progress in implementing the revitalized peace deal since the six-month extension of the pre-transitional period was announced. The president addresses the nation tomorrow on the country's 8th independent anniversary. Activists are also demanding the president release all political detainees as per the agreement, which is yet to be implemented. Winnie Chirino files this report for VOA from Juba.
Edmund Yakani, Executive Director for Community Empowerment for Progress organization, says since the signing of last year's peace deal, there's been little to show for it. He says while the parties continue to blame each other for the slow pace of implementing the deal, the president should explain to citizens what parts have been implemented to restore their confidence in government.
We want to see from the speech of the president, if the president can confirm to us, the last IGAD communique has called for a regular face-to-face meeting of the top leadership of the parties to the agreement. And the idea of this platform of face-to-face meeting is meant to increase the level of trust and confidence among the principal of the parties to the agreement so that they can deliver what is called the pending issues for which are preconditioned for the formation of the government on the 12th November 2019.
Yakani says the public needs to know if the leaders of the former warring parties have been meeting so they can believe in the future of the country. He says Kiir should explain to the people the progress that's been made in the training of joint forces and the disarmament, demobilization and reintegration of fighters from the various groups. Yakani also worries about comments made by certain political leaders intended to curtail people's freedom of expression. He says some journalists, activists and even lawmakers have been threatened for speaking out about the situation in the country, and the president should address that.
And also I've seen the threat coming to the parliamentarians about they not speak freely, they have to seek approval from the speaker. So we need to present tell us that we are in a political transformation. Freedom of expression is very important, that we need to make sure people express themselves, express their views. And besides that, we have the state continuation of the national dialogue process. People need to talk.
Yakani praised Kiir for accelerating certain economic reforms by suspending all pre-sales by government officials of crude oil and appointing a committee to probe past oil pre-sale transactions. He says the results of that investigation should be made public. Jame David Kolok, Executive Director for the Foundation for Democracy and Accountable Governance, says he expects the president to offer an apology to the nation tomorrow for failing to establish the transitional government of national unity in May, and says Kiir should reaffirm to the public that the pre-transitional period will expire in November, followed by transitional unity government. And Kolok is calling on the president to pardon and release all remaining political detainees.
To make a pronouncement and order for release of any pending political detainees, including activists like Peter Beer, that hopefully we should be able to get to know tomorrow that he will be released.
Kolok says Kiir should also confirm officials are doing all they can to root out government corruption and that oil and non-oil revenues will be spent in a transparent manner. Augustine Dengalier, Executive Director for South Sudan Youth for Peace and Development Organization, says the president should address the concerns of South Sudanese border communities who accuse some neighboring countries of taking South Sudan's land.
We have issues now of the borders also coming up, that the president should make it clear to the South Sudanese what is his stand as the president of the country, as a leader to these issues of borders of South Sudan that is becoming seriously. Recently we saw from Kenya, Addis border and South Sudan.
Activists also say they want the president to show his government is carrying out the Maputo Protocol, which guarantees women's rights as well as the rights of IDPs as spelled out in Kampala Convention, which was ratified by South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Muni Serino in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Sudan, where a member of the Sudanese Freedom and Change Coalition says a joint legal and technical committee is working on the final draft of the power-sharing deal reached between Sudan's military council and opposition leaders last week. Babakir Faisal says he expects the document to be signed by both sides within 48 hours. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Khartoum.
The deal was reached between the Sudanese Transitional Military Council and the Forces for Freedom and Change Coalition to form a civilian government to run the transitional period of 39 months. Under the deal, military will head the sovereign council for a period of 21 months and civilians for 18 months. Faisal says the technical committee tasked with drafting the final power-sharing documents is almost done.
The legal technical committee is still doing its work and is expected to finish it tonight. And after finishing the formation of the drafting of the agreement, it will be signed tomorrow or the day after tomorrow. and then it will be followed by the formation of the Sovereign Council.
But Faisal says that the official signing ceremony, which is scheduled to happen next week, will be attended by the regional and international leaders, including South Sudan President Salva Kiir.
The ceremony is going to be next week. There are going to be like Prime Minister of Ethiopia, other presidents from the region and from international organizations, from the European Union and Troika countries and so on.
The power-sharing deal stipulates that civilians shall lead the Council of Ministers, who shall form a competence cabinet. Faisal says the coming government shall be tasked with reforming institutions in the country and the entire living condition in Sudan. He says, for the last 3 decades or more, Sudanese have endured a lot of hardship and people's lives need to be changed for better.
Our priorities shall focus on peace, and then we have an economic program just for the 6 to 9 months to improve the living conditions of the Sudanese people and lower the price of the commodities, and then to fight corruption.
Faisal urges the Sudanese people to continue supporting the political forces during the transitional period so that to achieve the vision of which the revolution was called.
We hope that the Sudanese people who led this revolution will be part and parcel of this government through their continued support to achieve those goals within the next 9 months.
In his address to the Sudanese nation over the weekend, which was broadcasted through the Sudan TV, the head of military council, General Abdul Fattah Burhan, vowed to implement the power-sharing agreement. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum, Sudan.
In Gambia, civil society groups have embarked on a campaign to combat rape, sexual violence and sexual harassment. This follows rape allegations leveled against the exiled Gambian leader Yahya Jammeh by some Gambian women. Pandiri Mbai reports from Blunt.
Sex is widely considered a taboo subject in the Gambia, rarely discussed in the open. Religion and cultural beliefs are often invoked to shy away from raising awareness on the matter. This has led to cases of sexual assault and rape not being reported to the police. With the help of Human Rights Watch, Gambian rape victims have started speaking out. A 23-year-old Gambian beauty pageant winner, Fatou Diallo, is on the forefront of a campaign to combat rape. She says she was raped by the former Gambian president Yahya Jammeh.
I can't wait to face Yahya Jammeh. I was 18 years old when he raped me in 2015. I've spent the last 4 years wanting to erase, to hide that it didn't happen.
Soon after Diallo made her accusation, many other women took on social media to say that they are also victims of rape. One of them alleges she was raped by an official of the Gambian Foreign Ministry. She says the official is married to her aunt. That woman is now taking heat from family members for exposing her story.
Being scared to actually come out and share my story after I got the courage to do it yesterday, I had people that were close to me that were like, why did you have to do that? Why did you have to share your story? And being judged and being asked why I speak out was one of the many reasons why I actually never spoke about it.
Sekou Cisse is a communication officer at the Gambian Foreign Ministry in Banjul. Cisse says the accused official has been placed on administrative leave pending the outcome of his case and says the government has an obligation to investigate.
One of the fundamental principles behind his suspension is that the government of the Gambia had enacted Women's Act 2010, Sexual Offences Act, and also is a signatory to the United Nations Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women and the Protocol to the African Charter on Human and People's Rights on the Rights of Women in Africa. The government of the Gambia, as a respecter of human rights, is obliged to implement these instruments.
Gambian civil rights groups and activists this past week staged a demonstration condemning sexual violence against women.
We will speak up no more. We will speak up no more. We will speak up no more.
There are no official statistics on the number of rape cases recorded in the Gambia. The Gambian Justice Ministry has opened a rape hotline calling on victims to get in touch with the ministry or the police. Mamadou Sabali is a former Secretary General and head of Gambia's civil service. He also served as Gambia's presidential affairs minister under James rule.
I think any honest Gambian would agree that there are issues of sexual violence in our country, in the level of the households, in public offices. But a conversation has never emerged out of these issues because of obvious reasons of honor and privacy issues.
Sabali says victims of sexual violation should be encouraged to speak up. He also says all barriers hindering the fight against rape should be crossed.
I think government and institutions need to come up with very clear policies, and the laws regarding these issues should be implemented to protect especially women.
Sabali, however, says he thinks the country probably does not have a modern scientific laboratory in which rape evidence can be properly studied. For VOA Africa, this is Pandering by reporting.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, members of ECOWAS talk about adopting a single currency. Find out how that will work when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what types of behavior are not acceptable in politicians?
The act of lying to people to get what you want, and at the end of the day, not serving the people.
If a politician maybe wants something or wants votes, does not mean you have to go create chaos around or you fight your opponent. No, it's not supposed to be like that. Do things in your own way, but in a peaceful manner.
A politician should not be aggressive to the public. A politician should not boast about himself. He should not be always talking about himself that I'm doing this and this and this.
Not being truthful and honest, because you tell somebody one thing and you're able to convince them, and then when you come to power, you're doing a different thing. Then it kind of disappoints them.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus. 15 members of the Economic Community of West African States, known as ECOWAS, have agreed to adopt a single currency known as the ECO to boost trade, investment and commerce in member states. Mike Bonye has more on the prospects of a single currency from Lagos.
Chisom Onwokwe is a Nigerian businessman who sells shoes, clothes, leather belts and toothpaste made in Nigeria in Benin Republic, Togo, Ghana, and Sierra Leone. He says the ECOWAS decision to introduce the ECO as a single currency is a step in the right direction. Chisom says it will be easy for him to do business with customers in the sub-region.
The proposed ECOWAS currency, the ECO, is a welcome development. It will make my business easy because I can transact with my customers with a single currency.
Chisom urges leaders of ECOWAS to ensure that citizens of member countries are educated about the new currency before it goes into circulation. Leaders of ECOWAS recently agreed in Abuja that the currency should be in place by next year. It will be phased in as the 15 countries meet requirements for debt levels, inflation rates, and other macroeconomic indicators. The heads of government of the sub-region say the currency will be based on a flexible exchange rate regime with a monetary policy framework focused on inflation targeting. Dr. Babatunde Adeoye, an associate professor of economics at the University of Lagos, says the single currency will boost economic activity in the grouping and improve trade relations among ECOWAS states and their trade partners. But the member countries will need to cooperate closely to stabilize the exchange rate of the new currency with their respective national currencies.
Each of those countries under ECOWAS has its own exchange rate, and the rate are being determined fundamentally by what the exports to the international market. For them to harmonize it requires some key steps to be taken. One of those things is by reinforcing the institution that will be involved in harmonizing the different countries' policies, both fiscal and monetary policies.
Adeoye says the business community in member countries will accept the currency provided that it is legal and strong. He says member states should tackle inflation, debt, and fiscal deficits to make their economies thrive with the new currency.
One of those conditions for a common currency union is for each of those countries to attain what we call both primary and secondary convergence criteria, of which it involves, you know, macroeconomic fundamentals such as inflation rate, fiscal deficit, debt, and so on and so forth. So by the time each of these countries get these things right, there won't be crisis. If you look at the case of Greece, one of those issues has to do with debt overburden, and I think it's a major issue whereby those countries in West Africa have to come together, because most of those countries also, they have that problem.
The idea of a common currency for the West African region started 30 years ago to boost cross-border trade and economic development. This is Mike Mbonye for VOA News in Lagos.
Cameroon says only a tiny fraction of refugees from Central African Republic have agreed to return to their country. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports for VOA from Yaounde.
49-year-old Florence Yuambi's husband was killed in crossfire between rebels and government troops in the Central African Republic town of Mingala 4 years ago. She fled to Cameroon for safety, where she has lived as a refugee ever since.
J'ai le diplôme, mais je peux pas travailler. Quand je pars chercher le travail quelque part là.
She says she spent her last 3 years studying in Yaoundé to become an accountant. If she returned to the Central African Republic, says Yambi, she is not sure to find a decent job. She says she prefers to sell bottled water and soft drinks to university students in Yaoundé, where there is peace, and take care of her 3 kids. They are certain not to get a good education in her country, says Yambi, because it was devastated by war. The CAR has been rocked by violence since 2013, when mainly Muslim Seleka rebels ousted then-President François Bozizé, prompting reprisals from mostly Christian militias. In February, authorities reached a peace deal with 14 armed groups following United Nations-sponsored talks in Khartoum. It was expected to usher in a period of stability and lead to an agreement between Bangui, Yaoundé, and the United Nations Refugee Agency for the CAR refugees in Cameroon to return home. But only 6,000 refugees have so far agreed to leave. Most, like Yambi, refuse to return to the CAR, citing fears of violence in some areas and a country devastated by war. Viviane Balkua is the CAR's Minister of Humanitarian Action and Reconciliation. She says her country needs its citizens to return and help develop their communities and the nation.
Ce qu'il faut retenir, c'est que nos compatriotes vont rentrer, ceux qui veulent rentrer, vont rentrer.
She says she is reiterating to her compatriots who agreed to voluntarily return that they will be treated with dignity and that the CAR will protect them and respect all conventions it has signed to uphold their rights back home. The UNHCR representative in the CAR, Buti Kale, says violence has declined since the peace deal, especially in the CAR's western and southwestern areas.
One would not say everything is perfect, but one would say that for all those who are willing to go back, there are chances that they would be well reinserted into their areas of origin.
But several armed groups have rejected President Faustin Archange Touadéra's cabinet because only 6 of the 14 armed groups that signed the peace are included. Skeptics of the CAR peace deal point out similar agreements in 2014 2015 and 2017 quickly fell apart. The UN says over 600,000 Central Africans remain refugees in neighboring countries, while over 650,000 are internally displaced. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaounde.
Kenyans affected by dwarfism are using football to fight stigma. The Short Stature Society of Kenya formed East Africa's first dwarf team just over a year ago with the hope of turning it into a national league to spread across the region. Sarah Kimani has the story for VOA from Nairobi.
In Nairobi City Stadium, a football team stretches, jogs and makes quick fist bumps. 10 minutes later, a referee blows the whistle, marking the start of the first friendly match between Kenya's Lion Stars FC team and the Macmillan FC, made up of under-14s. This is no ordinary game. It is a match between Kenyan dwarfs against a teens club. Ruth Mweni, the chairperson of the Short Stature Society of Kenya, is among the founders of the Lion Stars.
It was a good idea to start it because it creates awareness about us. We need people to know about us. Let us tell a story about ourselves, but not people to tell a story about us.
The Lions lose the game against the under-14s 2-0, but easily take the one against the under-10s 1-0. Lion FC team captain Joseph Maina is happy with his team's progress.
From the look of the games that they have played, I can say that from day to day, my guys are improving a lot. If we are to complete this journey and hit our target, that is the World Dwarf Games and the Copa Rabaja in Peru, they have to believe in themselves.
The other teams say they have a worthy opponent, as Joseph Ocheng, the coach for under-14s, explains.
If they can be motivated, they can do very well. Actually, they are opening, they are running. I think they have a very good team.
Estimates from Kenya's National Bureau of Statistics indicate that about 3,000 Kenyans are affected by dwarfism. The Short Stature Society of Kenya has just over 600 members. They use sports to come together and fight the stigma often associated with their height. The team, however, has challenges to overcome, as Mweni explains.
In terms of equipment, like the soccer ball that they are using currently, it's not the normal size. Size 4. We have one. We need more.
Apart from soccer, the society has badminton players who will participate next month in a world championship tournament in Geneva. Sarah Kimani for VOA News, Kenya.
That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with Kang JJ singing in his native Nuer language. We've been listening to Kang JJ singing in Toknas. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being here. Please join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.